Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Our guest today is Jessica Gross, a writer whose nonfiction has appeared in the Los Angeles Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, Long Reads, and the Paris Review Daily, to name just a few. She has received fellowships in fiction from the Yiddish Book Center and the 14th Street Y, and teaches fiction and nonfiction writing at Eugene Lang College at the New School. She joins us today to discuss her debut novel, Hysteria, published this year by Unnamed Press. Jessica, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to talk with you about the book. Our podcast, being an analytic podcast, begins with the same question every time. As far as we can know our motivations, what motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, as far as you can know your motivations, that's very good. So I entered what I didn't know was therapy with a psychoanalyst at the time in my early 20s. I'm now in my mid-30s. Over time, my once-a-week therapy transformed into full-blown psychoanalysis, and I became completely enthralled with the process of lying down on a couch and free associating and together constructing analyses of what I was presenting. So I was really passionate about psychoanalysis. I talked to my friends about it all the time. I read, you know, as a layman does, I read bits of Freud here and there, but really was very invested in the practice of it as I was experiencing it on the couch. And when I wanted to be a novelist for a long time, but it took me quite a while to get there. And when I was kind of figuring out the plot or whatever you want to call it of my book, what it was going to explore, the central questions, it felt clear to me that it would be about psychoanalysis in some way. But, you know, then a lot happened after that as it transformed into a very specific story.
Well, it's interesting. I read an interview I think you did with Brooklyn Rail that you knew you wanted Freud as a character, and that it's at one point in the process people were trying to talk you out of that. What was that about?
So I wrote the book, the majority of it, in an MFA program at the New School. I had started it a little bit before, and in my first semester, so I had come with this idea, which, again, I really can't, it's hard to say exactly where the specific idea came from, but the initial iteration of the book had the narrator's father dying. His family was Viennese. She went to Vienna to investigate her family history there, even though it was set in modern times. Freud just appeared, and then other stuff happened. In the very first workshop, I got a lot of really helpful suggestions. I got the suggestion that her father should be alive rather than dead so that she could actually interact with him in the real time of the novel. Great. yeah, other suggestions along those lines. But I also got the suggestion that why was Freud going to just appear in the narrative? It could easily just be a therapist, just a normal therapist who exists in the, you know, in the same timescape as the narrator, which is, you know, within the past 10 years. And I felt just incredibly stubborn that Freud should appear in the novel, but it was helpful pushback because it caused me to become detached from the concept of literal Freud just anachronistically appearing in the world of the narrator and to envision a kind of looser interpretation of his presence. So maybe he's just appearing. Maybe he's a delusion of the narrator's. And that was really freeing and definitely much more interesting. And I still had to justify his presence, but it became easier when it was more readily tied to the narrator's psyche.
And how was the decision to make him a bartender?
Well, once I realized that the absurd premise of Freud appearing meant that he didn't have to appear in Vienna and could appear in Brooklyn, I started really having fun with it. I had traveled to Vienna, you know, ostensibly as novel research, also because my father's family is Viennese, and I was curious about it, and I just didn't have a very good experience there. So I decided I didn't really want to set the book there anymore. And then I started thinking, okay, so if it's just in Brooklyn, where would this narrator go? And where would she happen to encounter Freud? I remember one of my professors kind of provided whatever prick to my imagination was needed to get me thinking along these lines. She said, where did he come from? Is he delivering some Chinese food she ordered? Where does she see Freud? And then I thought, okay, not that, but what? And, you know, I'm sure unconsciously I was thinking, okay, about the trope of a therapist bartender, but it bizarrely wasn't, it wasn't so conscious as me trying consciously to create some kind of parody of that, although in a way it kind of is.
Well, actually, I'm glad that you said that because one of the things that I read this summer, because what else are we going to do but read while we're all locked inside, was something that Julian Barnes had said about biographers. He's not fond of biographers, and he's talking about a biography of Flaubert. And he said that the author seared the novelist with a terrifying theoretical grid, like an imperious chef branding false scorch marks onto a steak after it's been cooked.
Wow.
I really love that because your novel has, I have my own theoretical grid, but I'm looking forward to it, finding out what was conscious, like, oh yeah, I've read about this and which just came out of the story. You know, of all the Freuds that are, you know, you've done your homework. There's the throwaway line about the sister's piano and not throwaway, but it's just tossed in. You're like, oh wow, she's done her homework. Mm-hmm. How did you decide on early Freud?
How did I decide on early Freud? I'm not exactly sure. I think that might have been one of the unconscious elements of mm-hmm. it. You know, I kind of read around, but it was in the way of a novelist, not of an academic, sort of reading a couple of biographies, taking notes on what came alive to me and what I wanted to attribute to this narrator. And yeah, I don't know if I really had a dichotomy in my head of early Freud, late Freud, so much as I just wrote in what made this character, this projection, whatever you want to call it, come mm-hmm. alive for me as a writer. And yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe the vivacity or impetuousness of younger Freud was appealing to me in a way. That's a great question.
Well, she gets her wish, right? Put your hands on me. I mean, it's just terrific because like yes. that holds up. And you know, it's interesting. He says in a footnote that he says anyone interested in the development of catharsis into psychoanalysis should start with studies on hysteria and then follow the path. He says, which I myself have trodden. Hysteria. It's the title. And again, chicken egg. Did you write the book and go, oh, this is about hysteria as I understand it? Is it? How did that come about?
The title came way late into the game, which is interesting. And I was actually sort of ambivalent about choosing it as the title because I was being very literal and I thought, okay, she doesn't technically express hysteria as it was expressed in, you know, Dora or something like that, where there was like a very distinct somatic symptom that could be traced to a psychic cause. So my agent and I, when we were about to send the book out, each came up with a long list of names, and this was the one that happened to be on both of our names, or both of our lists. And I had this resistance, and frankly, I went into my analytic session and I talked about it, and she said, "Okay, you're being too literal now. It's a great title, so just it's enough." And that was sort of helpful. So yeah, the title was appended later on. And I feel like it deals with some aspects of hysteria as he was writing about in that case, which you know, my novel doesn't map onto that case, but it was very inspiring in writing it. I think it's a fascinating case. So yeah, it doesn't kind of take the definition of hysteria as he was using it there so literally, but if you think about it in a kind of broader and more colloquial sense, I felt like it fit well. Well,
and in reading it, I'm like, well, of course it's called hysteria. Like now, I mean, as many things are, I couldn't think of another name for it. It's perfect. So what's also fun for me with this is, the publication date, the official pub date is August 18th. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So on this program on August 17th, we had Daniel Nafo on, and she was talking about a book, The New Sexual Landscape in Contemporary Psychoanalysis. And one of the things she talks about is she and others, colleagues in the literature, have noticed over the past, say, 20, 30 years, that sexuality, sex, has really dropped out of the analytic literature. It's just not there. It's really sort of, it's now become conspicuous in its absence. So that's on this podcast on August 17th. On August 18th, your book comes out. And I'm like, well, here's the corrective. And there's two sentences here that I think are the most psychoanalytic sentences that I have read in a long time. And they are this. So your narrator, I imagined pouring all the men I'd ever fucked down the drain of a sink, then flipping a switch to shred them all to pieces, the grating hum of them being ground to a pulp and then sucked away. I mean, it's sex and aggression. And it feels, well, as a reader, as an analyst reading it, I'm like, oh, this is... you know, this is square one for the book, but tell me about that exchange and can we talk about the narrator, you know, from there and then go out?
That's great. I have to listen to that episode. And you know, I haven't read that much contemporary psychoanalytic writing. And so that is really interesting to me. And I'd love to hear more about, yeah, why and how sex has dropped out of the discourse in that way.
Tell us about your narrator. Besides possibly hallucinating Freud, tell us about her.
So I have to read that. I have to listen to that episode that you mentioned. That's fascinating to me. I hadn't realized that sex had dropped out of the discourse so obviously, and I want to hear and learn more about that. But yes, my narrator is. I guess she's been referred to as, quote, hypersexual, which is an interesting descriptor, not one that I used. But how would I describe it? She acts out sexually, I suppose. The book opens on her having just had sex 1 week before with a friend of her father's. The night before, she slept with her roommate's boyfriend, or sorry, her roommate's brother. So she has all of this like compulsive thoughts. She deals a lot with self-laceration, with shame, and kind of acts out in with men in this way, acts out her aggression, acts out her frustrated desires. But there's a lot of kind of edible background to her almost, rageful associations with men. She has a very frustrated relationship with her father, who himself has some kind of repression going on that we can't understand because he's a different person. So in terms of the way that she acts out with men, she seems to want badly to be seen and loved, but cannot give this to herself at all. And anyone she ever sleeps with, she needs to dispose of almost immediately. She connects with men in a kind of she's kind of in a consumptive way, I guess I would say, rather than an actual any kind of acknowledgement of them as a human being. There's a lot of objectification to her interactions with men. And as soon as she's exposed herself and her vulnerability, she wants to dispose of them, make it go away. That's kind of how I would summarize it, although I'm having a harder time than I anticipated. But I'm curious if that rings true to you as a reader, or to hear more about like your analyst reaction to those lines that you read, which were amazing to kind of hear read back, which has not happened to me before.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, as an analyst, I was like, I mean, it's that experience as a reader, when you read a sentence or two sentences that just floor you, that you just stop, you put the book down, you walk around, and you're like, oh my God, yes, 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 yes. And what's interesting when you say my reaction as an analyst, I think somewhere, again, either in the blurbs or reading about the book, people say, oh, this, strange and wonderful weird novel, or this strange, wonderful. And I guess as an analyst, there's nothing weird about any of this. I'm like, yeah, I know this person. I know this narrator. I know the dad. I know the roommate. I know, it's so hyper familiar as an analyst. And actually what's interesting with that is one of the things that people who have never had an analysis or who are thinking about it, Freud said many things, but one of the things that he said, which in my training was really sort of central, and he says, so it goes on in innumerable variations, and one can only reply that to say everything really does mean say everything. Mm. And so for me, your narrator is a gift for anyone who's wondering, am I too much? What can I say? Mm. Because I'm like, this is somebody, and in fact, you as the author have, in a sense, said everything about this. So I think it's a real gift.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. It means a lot to me, and it's really what I hoped as I was writing the book. I loved what you said at the beginning of that question, that it's there, I guess to call it strange is to kind of, is a kind of defense against acknowledging the fullness of one's humanity. This, to mm-hmm. me, I know so many people who have had all of these thoughts and feelings. I've had these thoughts and feelings, maybe channeled differently than this particular narrator. But I know a lot of people who've dealt with the extremity of the mental landscape that she's dealing with. And it was really, really important to me to give her space in the form of this novel to kind of speak at length, basically. And by her, I mean, I suppose me, but really anyone. I guess, to be honest, the ideal reader that I was imagining was like me in my very early 20s when I was struggling before I had found analysis, but really needed it, unbeknownst to me. So that's kind of who I really hope finds the book, is someone who thinks that this mental landscape is strange or abhorrent or whatever, and to kind of see it reflected back to them, and that there's space for it. That's
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Really important to me.
Very, very important. There is space for it. And I want to come back to that because there's something at the end I want to talk about. But you asked me if I thought that your description of her, you know, consuming men. And so when I looked over my, to steal Julian Barnes, my terrifying theoretical grid, I'm like, okay, here's the theories. In the psychosexual three essays, oral. Okay. Obviously Oedipal. You could find penis envy, certainly masochism, the repetition compulsion. Mm-hmm. And then what you just said, to give her space to breathe. One of my favorite conceptions is that the unconscious doesn't know time. There is no time in the unconscious. Mm. And it's funny, you're published by Unnamed Press. She's unnamed. her parents, I don't think, are named. Everybody else gets a name. Mm-hmm. But she and her parents don't get named. But, you know, I read it. And I went, okay, wait a minute. In reality, this takes place over, you know, a weekend. But it is so expansive. I mean, it goes back and forth in time, just, you know, the week before with Langham, and then the memory, and could be a screen memory. It's so expansive. It feels like the full, you know, 30 years as opposed to 2 days. It's really, really expansive. Mm-hmm. So one of the person that gets a name is her roommate, Jojo. And this, there's what she makes up in her head. Then there's the actual, you know, meeting with Jojo on the stairs if she comes home. And I'm like, oh, well, this is about a projection. She's decided everything Jojo thinks. How did Jojo come about?
Well, this was one thing that changed over the course of drafting the novel in an MFA program, which, you know, unlike any other novel I'll ever write, I got tremendous quantities of feedback throughout writing this manuscript. So I initially had the narrator have two roommates. There was Jojo and then there was Layla. And I got the suggestion early on to just smush them into one character. And I thought, okay, sure, I'll do that. Sort of early on in writing. And the suggestion came from, the motivation behind it was that there was kind of, Jojo was like the angel and Layla was more of the devil. And it felt like very crude the way I had sort of divvied up their roles in the narrator's life. And so why not create one actual complicated character out of these two people, and it would be much easier to deal with narratively. But I think that's interesting because so much of this narrator's experience is about triads and comes back to the original Oedipal triangle and feeling left out of her parents' dynamic, feeling rebuffed by her father. And so I do think it's really interesting that I started with her, with that triangle, just mapping onto her relationships with her roommates also. But as for the other details of JoJo and who she was, the fact that the narrator had slept with her brother was really early on. I sort of wanted to set her up with a lot of behavior that she would have to deal with later on or analyze. And so that came really early on. And then the interactions between the two of them sort of just flowered from there in a way that I can't totally trace. She just kind of took on life as I was writing her. And she appeared immediately with the name JoJo. It wasn't It wasn't like a what should I name her? I don't know how that happens, but she just plopped into my mind with that name and looking like she did. Although I made an effort. I really don't like very intense physical descriptions of characters when I'm reading because it interrupts my imagination. So I gave details here and there about what everyone, including JoJo, looked like, but not a lot.
No, not a lot. And in fact, it's interesting because for me, JoJo is defined by the narrator's action very early on the couch, the detail of either doing or wanting to slide her feet under her roommate's legs. I mean, it's the whole thing expands from there. It's just that type of detail. You're like, boom, I know a lot about them from that. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about things that are symbolic, but maybe I'm going to say narcissistically symbolic because it's set in New York. And, you know, New York, whenever a novel is set in a specific place, that place becomes a third character. So, or a fourth character. So she, you know, at her bar, she orders a dark and stormy, which is like the most perfect, you know, cocktail. I'm like, okay, well, that's great. I do want to know where in Brooklyn you can get a cocktail for $7 because I don't know about that. But there's reading it as someone who lives in New York, the crossing of the park on M86, that going from the west side to the east side, they are so, I mean, it's almost like a hero's journey. I know someone in New York who was raised on the east side, where she was raised. And as an adult, will not go there. She won't go to the Met. She just can't. She's now West Side. It's such a huge, the park separates these two worlds. I think it's hard to understand if you don't live here. Is that consciously in your mind? Okay, this bus ride is a very specific bus ride that you can take.
Yes, it is. I was an Upper West Sider for a long time. And have a lot of allegiance to the Upper West Side. I think that story you told is so interesting because, they're not actually that different in reality. I mean, probably socioeconomically, they're pretty similar. They look not that different to an outsider, but there is, I feel like the minute differences matter a lot to somebody who considers themselves a New Yorker. But mm-hmm. I think for the person that you described, as well as for my narrator, the kind of New Yorker-esque differences and allegiances of those two sides of the city are totally conflated with her feelings about her family. The Upper East Side is where she grew up. It's where her family lives. And that was very complicated for her. She has not resolved her feelings about her childhood. And so it is fraught to go back to the Upper East Side, even apart from, you know, the sort of hoity-toity associations of that neighborhood, if you want to call it a neighborhood.
Right. And then in the central memory is the reverse commute in a way, which is they have to get to Met Opera, you have to go east to west.
That's right. That's so great, yeah.
So we have a psychoanalytic novel. We know that Freud loved creative writers. He called them valuable allies. He actually says at one point, he says, "It strikes me myself as strange that the case histories I write should read like short stories." Mm. And then in an interesting overlap, I got your book and I got the new Ferrante. Mm. And I start reading them the same night. And then all of a sudden, wait a minute, I'm mixing up my daughters and fathers, so I had to put her down. And then in the interview you did with Brooklyn Rail, David Gerard says that your work is reminiscent of Philip Roth and Ferrante. So I went back to Ferrante because she loves Freud. She's read Freud. She really gets him. But she says something that I think addresses. So if your narrator is read by the 20-something who needs to understand, you're free to be this. There's no such thing as too much. This is great. Other concerns that people have, and I think Ferrante, she says, "I've never been in analysis, but it is rare that one saves oneself from a rickety landing at the top of a building by throwing oneself down the stairwell." So that's a common fear. As someone who's written about it, read it, experienced it, what would you say to the person that says, why would you do this?
I mean, it was interesting. I think that earlier in my time in analysis, I was such a devotee that I would just want everybody to do analysis. I thought it was the best thing in the world. Okay. And so I would have had a different answer than the one I have today, which is that it has been one of the most fascinating and worthwhile experiences of my life. However, not everyone is me. And so when I went into analysis, I had a good amount of pain and I really, really needed somebody to listen and to help me deconstruct what was going on. So I think that the motivation of that amount of pain was incredibly helpful in getting me over the discomfort of what it means to, pick apart your psyche thread by thread. It isn't entirely, it's a fascinating process. It can be exhilarating, but there are difficult elements to seeing yourself more and more clearly. So I guess that now I would say it did not feel like throwing myself off a building, but there is certainly discomfort involved in that kind of self-reflection, self-analysis, or analysis reflected back to you by another person, there is discomfort. And so I do think that the motivation has to be there and that people who really aren't into it can't be subjected to it. I don't know. I'm curious how you would feel as an analyst. What's your answer to your own question? If I can do that.
Yeah, sure. That is not what happened. That you don't throw oneself down a stairwell, that in fact that terror is pretty common. That's not what happens in analysis. You don't throw yourself down mm-hmm. a stairwell.
Yeah.
Nor does your analyst throw you down. I think that's the other thing, which is, this person is going to do X to me. Mm-hmm. So I'll tie it in. I keep thinking I'm going to be chronological here, but that's just not going to happen.
Can I just interrupt? Because this gave me furnished me with a memory that of my own analysis, which I want to share, which is that I remembered when I... There were various things that I think that my analyst knew for quite some time or had detected were probably true about me. I struggled with an eating disorder for a really long time, unbeknownst to me. But it was quite a ways into the analysis until she really even broached the possibility that this could be the case, maybe a couple of years into it. kind of waiting for me to be at a point where I was ready to deal with it, I think. And I do remember when I increased from 2 to 3 days a week and was about, I was very afraid of lying down on the couch as opposed to sitting up on the couch and looking at my analyst, lying down and having her sit behind me, which is kind of akin to this fear that you quoted of throwing oneself off the building. I was just scared that all of this stuff would just, horrible things would just pop out of my mouth. And we did a lot of talking about just the fact of lying down on the couch before it happened. So there's always room for, I mean, it's a very slow process is the thing. So there's always room for even processing the process. There's no force feeding. It's not like that. It goes at the pace of the person who's in the therapy. So yeah, I echo your point. Even so, I think there's elements of it which might not, you know, yeah, which if you're relatively fine, if you choose not to do it, 22-year-old me isn't going to spite you.
the idea of that it unfolds in a slow process is also Ferrante, who I just, you know, she says, listen, the problem is that real change takes a long time while life hits us right away now with all of its contradictions. Mm-hmm. So she really sort of understands how tangled it is. Yes. But the other person that this was reminiscent of is Philip Roth. And I don't want to give it away because I want people to read the book. But I'm reading the book and I don't necessarily have Portnoy's complaint in mind until I'm, you know, at that point of a book where you're like, oh, I can see that I have one page left. And I'm like, how is she going to end this? I don't know. She's like, you know, it's like a pitcher. How are you getting out of this inning? I did not know. And it was brilliant. It's a brilliant last line. It has a repetition compulsion in it, but it also does what we mentioned earlier, which is the space is created for the rest of the story to be told. I'm being very coy here, mm-hmm. but it's just, it's good. Did you have Portnoy's complaint in mind or Roth at all?
Yes. Yes, I absolutely did. I read Portnoy's complaint now, it's about 10 years ago, and it was, it influenced me a lot, but I was careful not to reread it right as I was writing because I wanted it to be sort of embedded in my being in a way that wouldn't be, that I wouldn't just recapitulate any elements of it. However, the famous ending of Portnoy's complaint is so memorable, it was impossible to forget and was definitely inspiring to me. I will be coy also. I don't want to really give it away, but it was important to me that the ending of the book be the beginning of something for yep. the narrator. Yeah.
Well, you did it. I'm going to go back to this idea of Central Park and what that means. I had what I think is probably an even more New York narcissistic reading of it, but I'll ask you about it anyway, which is, so your narrator has a memory. And so I stopped short. Now, my problem that I bring to it is that I adore the Met. Mm-hmm. I love Met opera. Love it, love it, love it. And so I read, you know, she has the memory of the expansive summer night. And I went, wait a minute, the Met's dark in the summer. It goes dark at the end of May. Not that it can't be warm in May, but I'm like, oh wait, this has to be a fantasy. Couldn't be summer. Then I'm like, this, you know, her parents are East Side, you know, certain amount of solvency, and I'm like, why are they in the balcony and not the grand tier? I'm like, oh, this can't be a memory. But then I'm like, wait a minute, she leaves the auditorium. And then she comes back in and I'm like, nope, unless you're in the parterre box, they will not let you back in. And then she says, she says, in my memory, a little girl stood still, a stunned certainty that the little girl had never existed. I have the strange feeling I imagined her. So those are, you know, that's what you're writing. I'm like, oh, okay, this is a screen memory. She's mashing things up. Am I just reading it too closely because I love the Met?
You know what? So I actually prefer your reading to my intent. So let's just go with that. I mean, frankly, I've been to hear the Philharmonic many times, but I've only been to the Met Opera a couple of times. So I did see Werther at the Met Opera as I was researching this book. And I was lucky enough to have taken a knife skills class with somebody who worked at the Met Opera, who hooked me up with a backstage tour. I got to look at the old 90s program of Werther, which would have been what my narrator probably saw. But I was not thinking very carefully about all of the factual dissonances as that you mentioned. And I did picture her having a literal memory, whether or not that memory has you know, morphed over time. I'm sure it has, but I did picture this originating from some actual event, but I think I prefer the reading that it is entirely a fantasy and that it didn't. I think that's great.
So let's talk about the opera you picked, though. Of all the opera, Werther is not listed as one of Freud's favorites. Mm-hmm. I think Don Carlo was his favorite, but he liked a lot of the Mozarts. How did you pick it?
I picked it, you know, I felt like the narrator's inner life was so, her emotions are so intense. And, you know, I'm not an opera expert, but I did know that you'd be hard pressed to find an opera that has like a muted emotional valence, but something about the story of Werther felt like it could hold, I don't know, that the narrator could map herself onto it particularly easily because there's such frustrated but intense yearning, desire, thwarted desire, which is her history. That's how I picked it.
Well, it's great because it leads into another sort of arresting moment as a reader. So from the analytic point of view, the idea of induced feelings, and I think the chapter before, you know, she's gone home. The narrator has gone to have a conversation with her parents. And her father, who's not a Freudian, her parents are CBT therapists, and her dad says to her, you know, she says she's getting nervous, or she says, you're making me nervous. And he says, well, we aren't making you nervous, my father said. Feelings aren't made by external circumstance. They're made by your own internal commands. And then luckily mom steps in and goes, would you stop? but then she's back at school, and she's teaching Darkness Visible, and a fellow teacher says to her, aren't you worried that it'll be contagious? Do you seriously want blood on your hands? She says, that's absurd, I told him. It doesn't work that way. You can't induce despair by writing about it. No one ever committed suicide because of a book. And of course, people did. When Werther was published, men dressed up in blue coats and yellow vests and killed themselves.
Oh my God. I did not know that.
You didn't know that? It's called the Werther effect.
Oh my God. That's incredible. That's terrifying.
So yeah, I was like, oh wait, that's so brilliant.
Wow. Yeah, that was unintentional. So thanks for attributing it to me.
I do. but here's the thing. It makes, this is why this, that your narrator, this person, is so just real, three-dimensional, recognizable. It's great. So that moment really, really stayed with me.
Wow. That's incredible. Sorry to disappoint, but I'm totally enthralled by that.
Yeah. Gosh, what else? What are you working on now?
Well, I am working on another project, which I hope will develop into a novel, but it is at such an early stage that I don't feel I can summarize it in any way. It is an amorphous blob that will hopefully become a book at some point.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, listen, as I said throughout the interview, I really wanted to talk to you. You've written a psychoanalytic novel. You've brought back sex. But I think that it is a book for clinicians to read and go, yes, this is this character type. This is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. And for people that want to sort of understand, like you said, what is humanity? You're not too much. You just are. So it's really terrific. And I'm so glad that you joined me today.
Thank you so, so much for having me and bringing your insights to my work. It's really thrilling to me.
Good. All right. This is New Books in Psychoanalysis. We've been speaking with Jessica Gross about her novel, published just a month ago, Hysteria.